so much of building that community is kind of that being involved with it every day. And talking to and greeting and introducing people each other and like, hey, you know, Sandra from Minneapolis, you know, have you met like, you know, Keiko, who's also from Minneapolis, why don't you guys meet each other? You know what I'm saying? It kind of just basically being this sort of like kind of the infinite party host and really building that community. And I still am in touch with and have Christmas ornaments that have been made by members of this community, some of whom have gotten married, had children, and gotten divorced at this point. So it's like, it's kind of an amazing story. It's like a real community. You know when that's happening.
This is the Family Podcast. This is your loyal Vlad. One episode every week showcasing an ambitious founder, startups, tech ambitions, best practices, inspiration, insights. Everything you need is right here. We are the family. We help ambitious founders all across Europe with anything they might need. It can be product, it can be fundraising, it can be taking care of their kids, it can be partying at a summer camp all together. Basically, if you want to build a startup, if you want to be surrounded by peers, by amazing people who already built or are building really cool projects, if you want to have brothers and sisters, you should have a family. And today's episode is with one of the first sisters, a Silicon Valley figure, a role model, Katharina Fake. She's an example of dedication and creativity. She built few startups. She's now an investor at Yes VC. She has a background in literature, in art. She founded Flickr, the photo storage website, with Stuart Butterfield, who became the CEO of Slack. She was on the board of Etsy, of Creative Commons, and she was interviewed on stage by Matthias Pastor, our director, and we talked about a few things like Himalaya, homeschooling, her new podcast, Should This Exist, which talks about the technology and its future. So many, many topics I think you're not ready for.
This is great. This is a good turnout. Hi, everybody.
Obviously, I get to ask all the first questions, and you have to listen, and then you get to ask the questions that you may have at the end. So before that, I get started. So there's 1,000 questions I want to ask, and we're definitely not going to get through all of them. I wrote them on one piece of paper. I tried to make it fit on one piece of paper. And I'd like to start with one of the first things that you started. Actually, I want to start even earlier than that. I want to start by you telling the story of how you ended up in San Francisco, because I think it's such... when you understand that, you understand how random life can be.
It's very random.
When you hear the story from what comes after.
So I was planning on climbing a bunch of mountains in Nepal, and I came... I was on my way to Nepal, actually, and my sister, who had moved to San Francisco, I hadn't seen her for a while. So I decided to stop in, and I had my ice axe, and I had my backpack, and I had my crampons, and I was like all kind of geared up for my big trek through the Himalayas. And I showed up at my sister's apartment because San Francisco was cheap enough that people had spare bedrooms in those days. My sister had a spare bedroom, which is unheard of. Like, you know, just to, I don't know, like, put your winter clothes in. Like, it was crazy. And so she, being my lovely older sister, just kind of put me up there. And then my trip got canceled eventually. It kind of became avalanche season. Like, some guy got injured. We didn't end up going. And so I just hung out in my sister's spare bedroom for about 6 months until she finally said, "Hey, have you ever thought of getting a job?" And so, you know, this being 1994 in Silicon Valley, the most interesting thing that's going on right there is the web. And it had just appeared, and I had seen Mosaic Browser come out, and I was a artist. I had actually planned on getting a PhD in Renaissance literature. That was my thing. I was also a painter. And I felt that I could use my skills in kind of, you know, aesthetics to become a designer. So I taught myself HTML. One of my neighbors was working at the very first web design company, and so there were no books about how to design for the web. It kind of didn't exist. You had to do it by viewing the source code on each page. And so I accepted a job offer on Friday, not having any idea what I was doing. And I was like, I went to my sister and I was like, I didn't even have a computer. And I said, Corey, could we go to your office this weekend so I could try to teach myself HTML? So it was like that. It was kind of it was a super scrappy, I kind of bluffed my way into the job. And it was just a series of accidents, truly a series of accidents.
And I think just as interesting as how you ended up being in San Francisco, how you came to interact with the web at all in the first instance.
Yeah, so I was really lucky in that I was kind of on the web very early, but I was a huge fan of Jorge Luis Borges, the writer. Is anybody like a lover of this writer? Yes! Yes! I high five you from over here. So Borges is an Argentinian writer, and he anticipated in many of his essays. This is a very friendly fern. You have a harassment policy, right? Here. I joined a group of Borges scholars. I found a bunch of Borges scholars online in like Denmark who I contacted, and like it was my first sense of how amazing the internet could be, because I was like engaging in conversations with these folks, and I had been like, this is kind of like super historical, right? But I had been really into zines and zine culture, and we had like made and published our own zines and kind of mailed them to each other. Like this is kind of like the internet, like talk about like snail mail. Like it was kind of like the slowest possible internet, but it was kind of very internet-y. And so that was kind of how I originally got into it. And I was always very into kind of independent culture and independent publishing. And, you know, that was kind of where I came from and how I got so interested in the internet, because it just seemed as if it was this amazing force for liberating people's voices and opportunities for people who hadn't had any chance to, publish anything and have immediate global distribution. I mean, just like all those things that kind of people talk about and about the internet, we've all kind of gotten used to, right? And it, these things that are so wondrous, you know, become just part of your daily life, and you kind of somehow don't see it anymore. But that was what it was. That's what got me into it.
Yeah, and I think that's like the perfect introduction to your career as an entrepreneur, is that it seems that it's very much centered around community. And if you look at the driving force, both of you as an investor and entrepreneur, community just comes and comes again. And can we start with Flickr, and just, can you give us, I think Flickr is an interesting example on many levels. One, on how important keeping an open mind and being happy to pivot is. If you can tell us a bit about the Neverending Game how you decided to transition, that'd be great. And then, of course, as a beginning of a form of social media, if you could give us a couple stories about Flickr's beginnings.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Flickr was not something that looked like it would be successful. There was not a lot of capital around, actually. We were building it in Canada, in Vancouver. We were building a game initially. The game had many, many passionate users. It was amazing, but we absolutely could not get it funded. We were only one person out of the five-person team was actually getting paid. The rest of us were just kind of scraping along. I had bought my first apartment, and I put not just one, but two mortgages on it in order to make the one guy's payroll to make this company. And we were eating, you know, this is kind of an exaggeration because we probably had some vegetables, but it seemed like we were eating like noodles for dinner every night, right? It was a fairly scrappy operation, honestly. And we were just about to give up. We were just about to give up and like throw in the towel and quit and close down the company, when it turned out we had this idea for this kind of a photo sharing platform, and decided to scrap the game and start working on this photo sharing platform. But we only had like a couple like, we really didn't have any money left. And so what had happened was we had applied for a grant to the Canadian government for this game, and we had been rejected for it. But apparently we had checked this box that said resubmit it for next year, and then we got it. And it was a couple of days before Christmas, and we were literally just about to shut the whole thing down. And we got a letter from the Canadian government saying, like, congratulations, here's a check for $75,000, which was like a fortune. And so that was what we started Flickr with. It was kind of an amazing, amazing moment. It was just a kind of a Hail Mary. And all these things in retrospect, you know, they're just extreme, like, good fortune, hard work, unwillingness to quit, general unemployability in other jobs. You know, these are kind of the qualities that I kind of attribute to my being an entrepreneur to begin with. You know, just bullheadedness, unwillingness to quit. Like, I'm an investor now, and I see these entrepreneurs, and they're just like, you just want to say, like, it's okay to rest and stop and, like, quit and, like, chill, and, you know, it's even okay to, like, you know, cut your losses and go do a new thing. But there's a certain personality type that just doesn't stop. So I kind of am that kind of person.
And what you didn't stop doing for quite a long time in the early days of Flickr, and sort of for quite a long time after that, was greeting new members. And a lot of people, greeting new members who had joined the community. So you'd insist on not automating that part of, like, the welcome messages.
Yes, and so my background was in online community, and I had even worked really early on with a guy from The Well. The Well was the original online community, in my opinion, that was, like, a really fantastic online community where I learned everything I know about building communities and people speaking in their own voices and kind of how you build that. And so much of building that community is kind of that being involved with it every day and talking to and greeting and introducing people to each other and, like, hey, you know, Sandra from Minneapolis, you know, have you met, like, you know, Keiko, who's also from Minneapolis, why don't you guys meet each other? You know what I'm saying? It kind of just basically being this sort of, like, kind of the infinite party host and really building that community. And I still am in touch with and have Christmas ornaments that have been made by members of this community, some of whom have gotten married, had children, and gotten divorced at this point. So it's like, it's kind of an amazing story. It's like a real community. You know when that's happening.
And why do you think founders tend to delegate that as quickly as possible or try to automate it? And why do you think they're wrong?
Oh, it's crazy. You know, it's funny. I got an email from a friend of mine, just acquaintance of mine who had an online community, and things had gone really bad there, and there was, like, a couple of really bad actors who were in there, and they were kind of harassing everybody and being kind of ill-behaved and just awful. And he was like, "It's shutting down my community, and, you know, all these people are leaving as a result." I'm like, "Dude, are you in there every day? Like, how did this get out of hand?" He's like, "He's been doing it for months." I'm like, "There's no excuse. Get in there. Like, you're the captain of the ship." You know, you're ultimately in charge. You're the CEO. And he said, yeah, but I hired a community manager. I'm like, you can't do that. Like, you can't just outsource this. You have to be part of the building of it, the cultivating of it, the, you know, gardening, right? The gardening of the community. You have to have both fertilizer and weed killer, but most of all, you need to be the gardener. And I think that's a really important part of these things. And those things don't scale, and those things are, you know, you have to have one conversation at a time. You know, it's kind of the only way that it can get done. And you know, what's interesting is that everybody, I did a podcast last year with Reid Hoffman. He has this. Do you guys know Masters of Scale? Yes. And I did this conversation with him where we were talking about social media, and he's like, you know, social media this, social media that, and, you know, Katarina, you were one of the progenitors, the, you know, godmother of social media. And I'm like, we were not building social media. We were building online community. Social media is actually something that came later when they wanted to harvest your attention, when they wanted to harvest your data. And it was a very dangerous, and I think things went kind of in a direction that they had not been expected to go from those of us who were really early on in building online communities, because when you could harvest people's attention. When you could build an activity feed, we could see this because Flickr had one of the very first activity feeds online, and it was copied by a lot of social media companies. But what Facebook started to do is they started to organize it by attention. And there was a big outcry, like organizing things by what gets attention, it's kind of obvious what's going to happen. What's going to happen is the most sensational stuff is going to go up there. What's going to happen is the most sexist stuff, the most racist stuff, the most
seven deadly sins.
Divisive stuff, the stuff that is most politically polarizing stuff is going to go up there. And when it turns out that you can actually buy your way on there, which we also kind of raised a hue and cry when that happened, what does that mean? That means that you cannot sell people just toothpaste, but you can sell them ideology. And we see this happening every day. You go, you know, you go on YouTube, 70% of all of the videos that people watch on YouTube are recommended. And recommended videos are radicalizing, right? You know, the New Zealand shooter in the mosque, he had been radicalized on YouTube, and you could actually see the pattern of his path through YouTube. He had been kind of radicalized by the stuff there because they know that that stuff grabs your attention. That stuff keeps you there. That stuff creates this compulsion to go back, and it's stimulating and it's sensational, and you can't resist it. And it's very difficult to drive by a car accident. But if you look up, if you're just like a mom, right? You're a new mom and you've just had a baby. They did a bunch of tests on this. Within like 5 videos, you will start to be fed anti-vaccination propaganda. Like moms, right? Like people who are just like looking there for advice on kind of, you know, caring for babies. It happens like so crazy. And that comes from the transformation, I believe, from what we were building really early on, which was online community, and transforming it into social media, which means that they're just basically selling your attention. And there's no real kind of desire or strength in your human connections anymore.
I mean, I think it's not just that. It's also that when you go from online community to social media, one of the implications is that you don't curate who's on the platform anymore and what they can say. And I think that a good example of that is your early days at Flickr.
Yeah.
I have no idea how this turned out to happen, but a lot of your users were in the UAE, so in the United Arab Emirates.
Oh, it was crazy. I know why it was because there was a very popular blogger whose name was E. Fatima, and she had been a super active. She's like really, really big in UAE, and had become a member of the Flickr community. And then within, I think, 6 months, the like 90% of the population of United Arab Emirates between the ages of like 18 and 35 were on Flickr. It was crazy. There's no screen here, but there's this like crazy diagram that we drew of our the Flickr community that was there. We eventually got shut down by the government. They just blocked us. So that was okay. That it didn't last for so long, but you know.
And the reason that happened was that because of your decision on the Britney Spears.
Well, yeah, because there was an outcry against there were a lot of women in bathing suits and with bare midriffs, and this was not okay, I think, with perhaps the government. But interestingly, we were very active. We took a very active role in booting off white supremacists, people who were behaving in kind of like sexist groups. There were like a lot of organizations that would kind of like appear. It's sort of the internet is it can be the Wild West with no sheriff unless somebody kind of takes responsibility for it. And a lot of what you see out there right now comes from the difference between a founder who thinks of what they're building is a community versus a founder who thinks that what they're building is media, because you kind of don't care whose eyeballs are there if you can sell them advertising appropriate to them, right? If you can sell them, if you have a large white supremacist community and you can sell them white supremacist, the people are willing to kind of sell white supremacist ads, then your business model, if you are oriented towards being a kind of a media company, just kind of dictates that. So it's just a very different way of looking at things. And I think that we just always had a very different way of looking at things because we thought of ourselves as a community.
Yeah, and you mentioned that one of the earliest people to work at Flickr said that you're just as bad as the worst thing that you tolerate on your platform.
Yes, and that's Heather Champ, who is the community manager. She said, you are what you tolerate. So if you tolerate, if you tolerate white supremacists, you're a white supremacist platform.
And
simplister, period. That's what you are.
And so how do you think that that should impact the way that, you know, both upstarts in the social media space and players should
I
act?
Mean, you know, it's really funny because I get in arguments with all of my colleagues who are all kind of like, well, the algorithm is neutral. The algorithm is not neutral. People have built the algorithms, right? There's a kind of a black box in Google and in Facebook, and there's a bunch of engineers in a room, and, you know, like, our governments, you know, kind of are visible to us, and they're creating laws, and, you know, they're elected officials, and we can see what they believe, and we can see how they vote, and there's a lot of reasons why that is all very public, right? Because you want to create a fair platform for everyone. But what's happening is that all of that power is actually shifting onto these platforms, and you can't see who's making the rules, right? You can't see who's writing the algorithms. You can't see, there's no you know, Senate or city council, or, you know, it's invisible to us. And yet those are kind of like decisions that are being made about, like, our experiences in media. And, like, you know, in the US, you know, the FCC regulates the media, but, you know, there's this sort of loophole that all the tech companies have gotten through by calling themselves a platform. You know, it's just, you know, if all of these people Google bomb a picture of Michelle Obama as a monkey, and Sergey Brin steps up and says, well, it's just the algorithm talking, like, just boggles the mind to me. Like, it just seems like this great, they're just absolving themselves of responsibility, right? It's kind of a huge fig leaf for neglect and of responsibility. And I also hear, it's funny, because I also get in arguments with people about the First Amendment, too. And the First Amendment in the United States is the freedom of speech. And the freedom of speech is incredibly important. It's very important for democracy. But what freedom of speech in the First Amendment is meant to address is when the government is jailing journalists, not when companies are writing software, because we are the, you know, empresses of our domains, right? We actually can decide what those values and mores are that are represented on our platforms. So I think that there's this very libertarian, techno-libertarian outlook in the Valley, which I'm very different. I just come from a very different orientation. I don't say that, like, no, I'd have no responsibility. The algorithms are neutral. I'm using the kind of the First Amendment as a kind of a fig leaf, right? I come out on a very different side on that equation. And I do think that the life experiences of the people that are building the software also very much dictates who builds it. Because, like, think about it. Like, if these platforms had built by, for example, women, they'd just be a lot, like, how would they be different? Like, ask a friend of mine this, like, if these platform firms were built by women. Well, number one, she said, they'd be safer. That have been built into it from the start. So, I'm kind of a bit of an outlier in the Valley. I don't look like, apparently, my cab driver told me this, like, the reason there's so much traffic is because Mark Zuckerberg is in town. I don't know if he's here for Viva Tech, but, you know, I think that if you come from, like, a very privileged kind of background, and you're like this, you know, you kind of, like, you're protected by this veil of kind of white male privilege, that you there's a lot of things that you just don't see.
And so, actually, coming to that, after Flickr, you got a bit of money from the acquisition via Yahoo, and one of the first investments, or maybe the first investment that you made.
It was the second investment.
Second investment that you made was in Etsy.
Was in Etsy.
And I think Etsy is just an amazing example of something that's often talked about but not really described with examples, which is the companies that could have been, had, or that almost were not, because there are so few women investors. If you can tell us about
that. And this was like 2006, and so there weren't a lot of, like, there were, as far as I knew, there actually weren't any investors in the Valley that kind of looked like me. right, who were kind of like a former entrepreneur, right? And it, like, goddamn, like if there had been a woman, like kind of former entrepreneur investor, I would have like run to her door, right? But there weren't any. There were women investors, but they were very similar to the male investors too. They had finance backgrounds. They're just, you know, I think it was just maybe the tech industry wasn't mature enough that enough women had successful exits that they could then become investors. And so when I saw Etsy, it was very obvious to me. I'm like, okay, so this is a marketplace for handmade goods. There's all these women, you know, and I literally took it to like Reid Hoffman, who said, so this is a bunch of women knitting sweaters and selling them to each other. And I'm like, yes! I was like, this is like, it's such a huge opportunity. And he was like, I'm not seeing it. And part of the reason I think that I could kind of see this is because it's a part of a movement. It was very clear that there was this huge movement starting, and we're talking about this is like 2005, 6 or whenever that investment was made, right? And it was a bunch of women knitting sweaters and selling them to each other, right? But it's huge. Everybody was rebelling at that time against, you know, mass commercialism and big box retail and Walmart and like what's the equivalent here?
Carrefour.
Yes, and you know, and you know all that kind of thing, and wanted things that were made by hand by people with names and faces. And this is like, this grandma from Illinois made my candle, right? And this was like the entire next decade was about this.
And it was right? More than that, because like the buyers were the sellers, and
the buyers were the sellers. It was like a huge community of people who kind of all knew each other, and it was a kind of an amazing thing, but it's sort of invisible, I think, to people who were not on these websites that were growing up. They were like blowing up of like knitting patterns, like, you know, this kind of, anyway, so it was.
And Reid Hoffman doesn't.
He doesn't, as far as I know, he doesn't knit.
Another investment that was in a similar, that had some similarities was Kickstarter. Which in a sense is an enabler of communities because it helps people fund projects that otherwise probably would not be funded.
And I think there's a thread. There's a common thread in all of the things that I have made. And the thread is that is literally going back to those days when I was like making and publishing, like literally photocopying zines and sending it to a bunch of other weirdos who are doing the same thing, to Flickr, which is a platform for photography, to Etsy, which was a platform for makers of all stripes, DIY folks and everything like that. And then getting to the point where crowdfunding was possible and people could start their projects. I mean, like, you know, I don't know, Spike Lee's like funding his movies on Kickstarter. It's crazy, right? And building a platform to enable that. I invested in it when it was like literally a PowerPoint deck. Like these guys, neither of the guys knew how to code. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, they, one guy had been, Perry had been, correct me if I'm wrong, Perry, if you're out there, I don't actually know if this is a story, but from what I understand, he was like a day trader, right? He was like trading. He was like one of those people like kind of like trades online. And he would take breaks occasionally, go down to this cafe. And the waiter at his cafe was Yancey Strickler, who became his co-founder. And these guys are not, I love this. This is what I look for. I love this. When people who do not look, when you scratch them, they don't smell like an entrepreneur. Like, they're these that's frankly my specialty. Those are the people that I invest in, right? Like, this guy, he's like 48 years old. He's been a short order cook for like 30 years. Like, that's my guy. Like, I love these. Like, these are the entrepreneurs I look for, like, as an investor, because I have always found that people from unusual backgrounds, with different perspectives, with just, you know, coming from some other industry or some other perspective that is very different from the kind of status quo. I mean, look at me, like, I don't fit in, right? I don't fit in there with all my kind of techno-libertarian, kind of the Travis Kalanick's and, you know, Sergey Brin's and Marx. Like, one of these things is not like the other, right? And so that's why I think as an investor too, I have always found these outliers. I love it, it's so much more fun. Like, why invest in the predictable people? Yeah. You don't get the thrill of, like, sitting in front of you guys and telling these stories about these, like, wacky people, like Rob Kalin, who's covered in cat fur, loved the guy, but he just wasn't, he's the founder of Etsy, right? He didn't seem investable, except to me, right?
He was a student. He was still a student when you met him.
He was a student. I think he had just graduated from Gallatin, which is a college at NYU.
That's crazy. Do you think that had Kickstarter existed, you would have been an author or tried to be a writer?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm still writing books. You know, I have this weird schedule. I go to bed pretty early, and I go to bed, like, I don't know, 10, and then I wake up at 2, and then I'm awake between 2 and 5, and I write novels in the middle of the night. This is my, like, hobby.
Did you go back to bed after?
Hobby, and then I go back to bed, and then I sleep for another 4 or 5 hours. It's called biphasal sleep. It's a thing. I don't know, like, Jack Dorsey's getting into it.
And that's like an endorsement.
So, which is, you know, like, he's like the lifestyle guru of Silicon Valley. I don't know if you guys read this stuff in the online, but he's like, yeah, I don't eat between Friday and Monday, and I sleep in 2 phases, and I only wear Rick Owens clothing. And he's, you know, he's the lifestyle guru of Silicon Valley.
Actually, I think parentheses on what I was thinking of talking about. I think that that's a good example. So a couple months ago, there was this whole controversy around Jack Dorsey and his retreat. I forgot what.
He had gone to Myanmar, I think.
Yeah,
he had gone like a meditation retreat.
Yeah, and he posted that picture in the cave.
And everyone's like, do you understand what's going on in Myanmar?
Yeah. But so that was a bit weird. But then there was like a whole movement that sort of went against him on social media, etc. And I was wondering if you had a couple comments on just the sort of behavior that has enabled.
Well, I mean, I think that in some ways, like, it's we all know feature creep, right? You know, I think it's responsibility creep, or kind of you're starting to take. This is the problem with. You know, I haven't really thought about this until just this moment, but it's kind of the problem with social media that doesn't scale, right? It's probably appropriate for him to share his clothing choices and how he eats with a certain number of friends. But when you have, like, what has he got, like, several millions and millions of followers, like, it's just going to land wrong, right? Like there's a, you know, communities have boundaries for a reason, right? They have kind of shared values. They have, like, this is okay here and this is not okay here. And if you're, like, really into, like, monster trucks, you know, those trucks on TV that, like, drive over each other, and there's these, like, massive machines and the tires are as big as this room and like that, like, that's one community. And then, you know, the Christian ladies quilt making society is another community. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they have, like, a certain kind of, like, amount of shared values. And then when you kind of try to popularize yourself to millions of people, it's just going to go bad. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's, you know, and the scale of social media has gotten to the point where we have been so promiscuous and friending people and kind of getting out there and connecting. We're, like, so connected. Like, we're more connected than maybe we should be, or can be, frankly. You know, everybody knows the Dunbar number. The Dunbar number is, you know, this guy, Robin Dunbar, neuroscientist. He's like, you can only have capacity to know between 150 and 200 people, which is the size of a tribe, right? Or maybe this audience. You guys can all introduce yourselves, become friends, you know. Make dinner together, but like approximately 150 people is really the limit of the number of people. And when you bring somebody new in, somebody else has to drop out. You just can't. You just don't have capacity. Like, you don't have mental capacity for relationships with more than that number of people.
And one of the crazy things that this has created is a huge sense of FOMO, anxiety, depression in a lot of people's lives. And I think social media keeps exacerbating.
Yeah,
that.
Totally. But you know, everybody knows. Everybody's read their blogs and their news articles and their research studies, so we don't have to talk about the bad stuff. But, like, you know, really focus on those people that you really, really want to have. Like, I don't know, write a secret list. Don't show it to anybody because all the other people get FOMO. But you know, the people that you really want to have a relationship with, and make sure that you talk to those people and see those people, like, every week. I don't know, because it's so hard to do, and I think that we've kind of expanded beyond our capacity to have those relationships.
I think so.
And what we were doing, like, you know, just to be clear, when we were building Flickr, we were building these kind of groups of 150, roughly. You know, we had lots of groups, and those groups were coherent and cohered and had their own kind of person to be the, you know, den leader kind of person. Yeah.
One thing that I found super interesting in your podcast, should this exist, you should all listen.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one.
AI, of course, we have a lot of
episodes already on the podcast. A lot of them are coming also, so subscribe.
Yeah.
You can check our YouTube channel, Startup Food, our Medium,
so
The Family as well, our website,
yeah,
thefamily.co, if you want to apply or just learn more stuff about what we do.
Oh my gosh.
It's always a pleasure to share content. We do it with love and with a paid forward mindset. So if you like it, just show the support by leaving a comment, leaving a small rate on the podcast, or by sending us heart emojis on Messenger as well. We accept those.
Yeah, no, it's like kind of trying to examine the full kind of spectrum of what tech might do.
Which is good because it's something that's missing, right? You have like super optimists that are like, this is going to be amazing. Why is everyone complaining about the downside, the downside, what happened? And then you get like super critical opinion pieces on the New York Times, which are like, why Silicon Valley
kill
is
it.
Fucking
like
everyone
Like, stick
over.
A knife in it. Yeah, no, it's true. And it's really difficult to put a nuanced view into media. It's really difficult, actually.
We get drowned by the radicals.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of naturally polarizing because it's, frankly, it's entertaining. A friend of mine is this guy, Van Jones, who is on CNN. He has a show. He's a kind of a political commentator on American television. And he was on a show with Newt Gingrich, who is like a super, super right kind of figure in American politics. And the two of them are kind of on very different ends of the political spectrum. And they were on the show that was called Crossfire. And they were arguing from very, very polarized positions. And Van had proposed that they have a part of the show that they close on, which was called Ceasefire, where they take the best parts of the argument that the other person had presented and show how they had been convinced by them. But the TV producers wouldn't do it because it was very difficult. It just didn't make good TV, right? And so we wonder why, you know, how we get so divided, how we end up with, like, you know, kind of the America that we're living in right now, and, you know, Brexit, and there's like so many examples of this worldwide. What we're trying to do on the show, should this exist, is actually have a kind of a nuanced discussion about how technology can both kind of serve and kind of dehumanize, frankly, humanity in many ways. And so, and you know, I'm a techno-optimist. I'd say I used to be one of those techno-utopians. I was just kind of like, in love, everything is good, we're gonna figure this out, like, you know, love, possibility. I was just this kind of like possibility machine. And then things just started to go really, really not in a direction that we had thought it would go. And, you know, whatever, teenage girls are now committing suicide at a rate of like 30%, like year after year, like increase. It's horrible. And this is part of our responsibility as kind of like the people that are building this technology.
So back to the AI therapist.
Oh yeah, that was where we started. The AI therapist is super interesting because tech has created like this epidemic of depression and solitude and isolation and loneliness. And it's a therapy bot where you have a cognitive behavioral therapist, which is basically trying to kind of change the direction of your thoughts from something negative to something positive. And it actually lends itself very well to a AI chat bot. But what does that mean when AI starts replacing humans, right? Because humans are by their very nature not available 24 hours a day. You know, I don't know if you had a good friend who you wanted to like kind of cry on their shoulder and it was like 3 a.m. and they're like just not available. Or frankly, they're just sick of your hearing your problems, or like annoyed with you, they're in a bad mood. They're flawed, but computers are not. Computers are always available. They will always listen. They will always be patient and loving and respond to you in positive ways. And like, they're better than people, right?
And they can do more hours of therapy.
They can do more. They can do, they said in the first day of WoBot's existence that had actually seen more, you know, clients or patients than a typical therapist could see in like their entire life in one day. And so, you know, should we replace ourselves? Are we too, you know, we need to sleep, you know, we're in bad moods, like, are humans obsolete? That's the question, right? This is kind of like the conversation around this. And like, what is it about being human, you know, that we value and we want to preserve, right? In the face of all of this, these new kind of, you know, possibilities and kind of AI technology in particular, that's what that episode was about. And so in the beginning, you know, we were thinking, well, maybe at the end of the show, we decide, should this exist? We answer the question yes or no. But I think it's more important to just keep asking the question, right? With every iteration, with every decision that you make, with every feature that you add, you keep on asking the question, should this exist? Should we do it this way? Should we do it that way? Is this being designed in a way that, you know, are we aware of the problems that could come as a result of this? And is this software, is it bringing us closer together or is it driving us further apart?
Before we open to questions from the public, I think there's two topics that I really want to cover. One is homeschooling. So education is a space I'm particularly interested in, and I'm curious of your experience as a homeschooler. And the other is women in tech. So just like in many other places, France has a lot of progress to do. Yeah. And you had some very interesting articles on Etsy's hiring policy. So like Etsy apparently was very focused and made a very conscious effort of hiring hiring more female employees. And I was wondering if we could discuss those a bit. So first, homeschooling, what prompted you to homeschool your daughter? And what have you learned doing that?
Is this a thing in France?
Not at all.
It's because there's like tiny groups I found online, like Instruction en Famille is what it's called, right? IEF. And because I looked it up, I was kind of looking around kind of the French organization. It exists, apparently.
Yeah, but it's like not as
but it's like
big a movement.
Kind of small.
Yeah.
And I was not a good student. I think maybe you can kind of tell that I wouldn't be a good student. I was a bit rebellious. I didn't like, you know, trouble with authority, you know, didn't want to sit in my seat and behave.
I made zines
in the back, like using the photocopy for purposes it was not intended. You know, so I didn't do well in school. I was actually a very poor student, but I was fortunate that I was really good at standardized tests. So when you take these standardized tests, I was like, off the charts, she's super smart. And then I was like, why is she failing school? So I was that student. So I didn't really take to institutions. And then it was kind of accidental that my daughter, I was kind of traveling back and forth between San Francisco and New York, and I was a single mom. And I was fully dependent on my daughter's caregiver, who is this older woman in her 50s. And she lived in San Francisco, and I was trying to work and she was like effectively my spouse. And so we were kind of traveling back and forth between San Francisco and New York, and it just didn't make any sense for her to go to a school. And her caregiver had been a preschool teacher, and so we started just taking her to homeschool groups and things like that. But also, I think being an entrepreneur, a lot of parents were kind of terrified of taking on responsibility for their kids' education. I mean, it's like a big responsibility, but I was lucky enough when I was a kid to be in this gifted and talented youth program, which was this big thing that was happening when I was a kid. And I was in these classes where basically what the way it worked was there was a, I did my regular classes in the morning, and then in the afternoon there was a teacher who helped us figure out how to learn what we wanted to learn. So, for example, I was really interested, I was 9 years old, I was really interested in ESP, extrasensory perception, telepathy, clairvoyance, the ability to read minds. Like this, I was super into this.
So you were taught that at school in the afternoon?
So, no. So, I mean, yes, because the teacher there, she joined, I lived in New Jersey in the States, and I she joined the Parapsychological Society of New Jersey, and we went to their meetings. It was actually kind of amazing. You like show up and it says, don't knock, we already know you're there on the door. And so like
you were 9 years old.
I was nine, and she would like take me to these meetings of this, and I devised all these tests of how do you test extrasensory perception and like all this kind of stuff. I eventually concluded that if there was anybody out there who could bend spoons or read minds, I certainly hadn't met them, because I devised all these tests. I tested all my classmates and the teachers and everybody, and nobody seemed to be able to, you know, I would think really hard about like a blue tiger or something like that, and they were unable to, nobody. What am I thinking about right now, guys?
Blue tiger.
Ah. Anyway, so, and that just kind of was, it's very similar to homeschooling, honestly. Like, you know, you kind of realize, I have these weird kind of, I'm kind of a monster about my time. Like, because I really do think that time is kind of all you have on this earth, right? To do what you with, to spend time with people, to do what you do. And I've always been a bit obsessed with managing my time, which is why I kind of do that thing in the middle of the night, that crazy thing that I do. And I realized that in 2 hours a day, you can learn everything that you're supposed to learn in school, right? So why are we in school for like 7 or 8 hours or however long you spend? There's like all this like getting in line and like you shut up over there and like stop passing notes. Like what? Like you kind of realize that like most of school is like all of that stuff. And I'm like, what would it be? What would life be like if you could actually take the 2 hours of school and then you like learn all your math and your trigonometry and, you know, genetics and basis? Like, she's crazy. Like, she's doing like astrophysics. She's 11, right? She's doing all these. But, you know, in 2 hours a day, you can kind of do school. And then the rest of the time, what do? You like, you're like, you can be Leonardo da Vinci, you can design an ornithopter, you can make, you know, you can write a play. In my gifted children's program thing, I like designed an orrery, like one of those things that kind of the planets rotate at the proper speeds, at the right distance from the sun. I designed an orrery, I wrote a play, and I studied extrasensory perception, you know, among other kind of wacky interests. And I was just able to kind of pursue those interests. And that's somewhat, it's kind of very DIY, it's very entrepreneurial. And I think it kind of creates a mental agility, right? You kind of understand yourself to be responsible for your own education. You understand yourself to be responsible for continuing to learn all the time. You start to know that you can just pick up anything. You know, I call it like YouTube University. Like, I don't, like, you know, my daughter's like, you know, wants to figure out how to do, I don't know, marbling paper, you know, that beautiful Florentine paper. I was like, I don't know, just try YouTube University. Don't look at any of the stuff on the sidebar. By the way, yeah, we radicalized the paper makers. I'm sure there's a way. But seriously, there's a you should download this. It's called DF Tube, Distraction Free YouTube, which will kill all of the stuff on the side. Go put that on your thing so you don't get drawn into, like, you know, you're gonna like arrive decent entrepreneurs and you're gonna leave like, I don't know, like kind of a member of a cult.
And so one, do you think it's a movement? And two, if it's a movement, what's the company to build on homeschooling?
A movement. Well, we talked about some already. So there is the DIY maker movement.
I mean, do you think homeschooling is a movement?
Oh, is homeschooling a movement? Homeschooling, it depends. I mean, I think in the U.S., definitely. I mean, like, it's crazy because out of all of the people that are sitting here in this room, probably in America, if this were a classroom, 5 of you would be homeschooled, right? Which is kind of seems like a lot, right? Doesn't that seem like a lot?
Who's homeschooled here?
You're homeschooled. Here in France? In France.
See? You're French as well?
In Spain.
In Spain.
So European homeschoolers, it's kind of amazing. And I do think that, you know, there's a fair amount of kind of government oversight, and you have to make sure that your kid's actually learning what they're supposed to learn. But imagine if you could get that 6 hours of your day back to explore, to, I don't know, start a company like my daughter started. And it's funny because I'm a investor, and so I get a lot of PowerPoint decks, and my daughter and my stepdaughter, they're like, what are you doing? And they're like, these are called investor decks. I kind of explained what we were doing. And they're like, okay, set us up. And so we set them up, and they made decks for Puppy Paradise, which was they're going to be their business. They're like, this is when they're like 8 years old. And it's like they're going to have video services. They're going to have dog massage. They're going to have dog walking. It was like everything that has to do. They just love dogs. You know, like, it was worthwhile. Like, I think it was like, because they had enough time to just kind of explore and play and do that kind of thing.
And do you think there's anything that's missing in your for you to homeschool better, or that would make homeschooling easier?
I don't know. I mean, like, the hardest part about homeschooling is actually driving to all of the activities and organizing carpools, because she's in like dozens of classes, and you know, she has to go here and there, and you know, she has this very rich social life too. So, you know, it's also America. It's too much driving. Not enough public transportation in America. Jeez.
Last topic before we open to questions. The hiring at Etsy. And the emphasis that you guys
hiring
made
at Etsy.
On
okay, so all these companies give like lip service to, and it kind of drives me crazy, because you know, you go to Google and they publish their, like, you know, everybody seems to be white and male, and nobody seems to be black or brown and female, and it's just like and they say this, right? And they kind of like publish all of their employee statistics, and they're dismal year after year, right? And I'm kind of like, you know, maybe I am thinking about this in too simple of a manner, but it seems to me that the way to solve this problem is to hire the people that you say you want to hire. And if you can't find them, then you make them, you grow them, you make boot camps, they go to the family and they kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like, they learn their skills and stuff like that. So that's what we did at Etsy, right? So it was embarrassing. Like, there was actually, it's a company that has 95% of its customers are women. And I was the only woman above a certain like VP level in the company, including the board. And I'm like, this is wrong. Right? Just, it can't be this way. So then all of the next positions that we open up are going to be filled by women. And it's funny because we went to our recruiter, there's a big recruiter, Diversa Partners in New York, and we brought them this profile. We're like, we're hiring a CFO for this company, and we want to hire a woman. And so will you give us resumes from eligible women? And they're like, oh, we can't do that. It's impossible. There's just like no blah, 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 pipeline. And they're like, we can't do it. And so we're like, just try. And so literally within, 2 weeks, they came back with us. And there was like, what was that American politician who said this? We got binders full of women, right? We got binders full of women. It's really funny because when I tell these jokes that are kind of like based on American news stories, you guys are like, huh? but it's so funny because they had never done a search like this before. They're like, actually turned out to be easier than they thought. And so we did that, you know, also with the engineering department. And, it's true, it's hard to recruit women engineers. And I never had a problem as a female CEO of a tech company. Fully half of my engineering team was women. And that was just because the CEO and founder was a woman, and also the VP of engineering was a woman. And we just like, we turned down more women engineers than most other startups would see like in a year, or like kind of on a weekly basis. Like so many women would apply because they knew it was a very friendly environment for women. Their boss was gonna be a, you know, female engineer. And so at Etsy, what we did was, since we had the so-called pipeline problem, was we basically created a kind of a Etsy coding camp. And we accepted tons and tons of women into that program. It was like not just women, it was both. It was kind of everybody. And then recruited heavily out of that. And I think that we were able to really move the needle there with the, I don't remember what we finally ended up with, but it was like, it went from like being 5% women in the engineering department to, I don't know when I left, like 20, 30%. It was a tremendous improvement. So, I mean, I'm kind of skeptical about these like, but we've hired a chief diversity officer at Google and we're still on it. Like, what? I mean, I don't know. I may be thinking about this in too simple of a way, right? Just hire more, anyway, so that's my thoughts on this.
Before we open the questions, I'd like you to join me in thanking Katrina.
Okay, hope you liked this one. Yes, it wasn't only about entrepreneurs, it was about many, many topics. She's really inspirational. If you liked it, or if you liked one of the previous episodes, please rate the podcast, review it, comment, share it, do your part, because we want to continue doing that. We want to see some support in order to make sure that you really like it and you need it. We want to keep giving advice and making sure our content comes in many, many different formats. Obviously, you can check our YouTube channel, Startup Food, our Medium, our Twitter, our LinkedIn. We are launching a lot of new communities like Decode for tech leaders, like Called Up for women who want to learn how to start a business online, like Pitch Don't Kill My Vibe for early stage startups and people who are interested in storytelling. So follow us and see you next week. Bye bye.